Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's really a treat to be here. And I'd like to thank Pat, first of all. She was our son's English teacher in West Point, and it's through her that we're here today. But also to acknowledge a deep kinship between Baha'i perspectives and those Unitarian Universalists. I noticed the six sources and the seven principles would make a wonderful study in terms of a comparison, and these notions of mystery, wonder, and prophecy, the wisdom, the relying on both ancient and modern teachings in your tradition, the wall-breaking instinct is very much in line with Baha'i perspective. So I wanted to acknowledge that at the outset. There's a children's song that Baha'i children learn called the Three Oneness that I'm offering as the structure of my talk today. And it, I think your wonderful pianist has figured it out just from sight. So maybe if you could play it, I'll sing it. So the first words go, God is one, man is one, and all the religions are one. Land and sea, hill and valley, under the beautiful sun. God is one, man is one, and all the religions agree. When everyone learns the three onenesses, we'll have world unity. So, and this is the melody that goes with it. All the religions are one, land and sea, hill and valley, under the beautiful sun. God is one, man is one, and all the religions agree. When everyone learns the three onenesses, we'll have world unity. So you can tell that under the simple surface of these phrases is a very adult complexity, sophistication, right? And so especially with that third one, which we'll dwell on, all the religions are one, we'll come to that. But fundamental to the Baha'i perspective is the notion in terms of God being one, that the divinity is the unknowable essence. That we as created beings with our finite intelligence, however incredible it is, right? That we have, you know, we have invented the Hubble Space Telescope and so forth, and get down into the DNA, and just astonishing what the human brain has done. In spite of that, we are creatures. We have a source with a capital S, the Godhead. And so the creature can never know the creator. The table can never know the carpenter, and so forth. So there are a lot of implications to that, obviously, and they go to the heart of a lot of current thinking, starting with Kant and going up through the Romantics, the idea that both what we half perceive and half create, and so forth. But, and then to Wittgenstein in the 20th century, saying that don't confuse the map for the territory. This is a deep, really helpful concept. Don't confuse the map for the territory. So we simply can't know the territory of divine reality in a direct sense. And in fact, it mentions somewhere in the Baha'i writings that warfare is, at least religious warfare, has largely been caused because people mistake their thought about God, their image of the holy, which is from your inspiration at the beginning, for the Godhead, himself, herself, itself. And that this is a problem, and when leads to the idea that God's on my side and therefore I can chop off heads and so forth. So it is as sophisticated as it can seem to compare it with Kant, you know, or even Wordsworth or our dear Emerson in the American tradition. Still, it's a very, very practical notion that we have to continually remind ourselves that our concept of God has to be undergoing an expansion. We have to continually, in our meditation, in our very experience, be realizing the blessed, unbelievably wonderful source out of which a human being could come. You just realize how amazing people are, human capacity. And so Baha'is believe in science, so we have an understanding of how science and religion goes regarding evolution. I could get into later, but just to say that this idea that the Godhead is unsearchable forever, as Baha'u'llah puts it, is the Baha'i concept. The second one, man is one, is kind of an old-fashioned phrase now because the term man can seem gender-weighted. So nowadays, usually in Baha'i communications, we use the term humanity rather than man, but still fits the rhythm of the song, right? And but this concept could be called the keynote of the Baha'i faith, the oneness of humanity. The oneness of humanity. So we have this notion that mankind over the last, 9 or 10,000 years, he established the circle of the family, then the wider circle of the clan, and then the tribe, and then with Muhammad, the nation state. And that now we're wrestling with this final circle, realizing we see it, through space. We see that this really is one planet, it's a circle. And that's the circle, metaphorically, that we are trying to fill, trying to achieve, the notion that we are one family. Science has proven it. We are one species living on one planet. National autonomy is necessary. National sovereignty is a problem. And so there are these implications to the concept of the oneness of mankind that go very deep indeed and get very subtle indeed. But they are ones that are of absolute practical importance in terms of our relating to each other, our overcoming of not just our prejudices, but our stereotypes, and learning to conform to a oneness that really is there in the ecology of life. But we build walls, and Robert Frost says, something there is that doesn't love a wall. Do you know that poem? That wants it down. It isn't elves exactly, he says. It's God. Now, I'm not talking about practical physical walls. I'm not even getting political, really. But in terms of barriers between people, and this is very much a you concept too, we really need to grow in our understanding of that baggage which we've inherited, which is holding us back and holding others back, and learning to overcome ethnic differences, and obviously the subtle gender ones, but especially ethnic differences, and then the deepest prejudice of all, religious differences that lead one to say, God is on my side, therefore I can, in championing God, I can do hateful, shameful things. I can mistake my righteous indignation, my hatred, for righteous indignation, and think that I'm a sword of God in, manifesting hatred. It's a deep problem, and so I've already started to get into the notion of religion as one, but let me just say, still on this theme of humanity as one, that that we see human nature as dual. This is really relevant the more you think about it, that mankind, we are spiritual beings having a physical, material experience. We're souls. But within this realm, in this life, the instincts in the animal side is really strong, isn't it? Passions are really strong. And we have to, all the traditions have said, we have to learn to transcend. We have to learn to be the rider of the horse. We can't give in to anger or to jealousy or to guilt or to lust. We have to rise above and then the animal side becomes beautiful within its in its place. So this pertains to our relationship with nature, which has gone through a huge change since the Middle Ages, when you could have a Saint Bernard who actually in his journal wrote that in traveling through the Alps, it was so beautiful, those snow-clad peaks, that he averted his gaze, you know, fearing that the devil would seduce him, that nature was, you know, of the devil. Because you can interpret some verses that way, right? And so, God, thank God, we have the English Romantics, stemming from the German Romantics, and people like Goethe and Wordsworth, and then Shelley, but then Emerson over here, and so forth, who have taught us, and now it's just second nature to us on all the Hallmark cards, even our ads with the backlit photography, that nature is great, and so forth. And that's true. But nature is also cruel. All things eat all things, but nature as a manifestation of the Creator, the beauty of it, the order of it, that's what the Romantics are talking about. Similarly with our bodies, that we relate to them differently when we're spiritual beings, when we know that we are souls having this experience. Then it is sacralized. Marriage becomes sacralized. Friendships do, but we aren't the victims of them, of it. We overcome the whole barrage of the media that trains us to objectify women, for example. When you just think about that, to objectify women and sexualize them in the way we see them. So we have it's a commercial society, so anything goes in a sense, but it means a greater challenge for us to know that we are spiritual beings having a material experience. And in other words, to be happy, to have well-being, not to be depressed, right? The blues has got us all. I mean, we're all, you know, just, it's like a fire licking at all of us, right, in our society, because it's so materialistic. So Baha'u'llah comes, we regard him as a Christ figure, 19th century figure, and he's just reminding us of what we know in one sense, because it's been the foundation of civilization, and that is that we have a nobility to us. We aren't just animals. We aren't just higher mammals. There is something in us that is not bound to the evidences of the senses. The smartest chimpanzee can never know that sun isn't rising, right? Never know. Why would he even consider it? There it's rising. But we do. And because we do, because we can sort of burst this mask of illusions with our math and our science, look what we've been able to do since the middle of the 19th century. Look what the human power is that, you know, God has created in us. Just unbelievable. So the very day that the Baha'i faith began, May 23rd, 1844, in southern Iran, Shiraz, over here in the West, the telegraph was being invented and sent out the message, what hath God wrought? And from then on, one invention after another has potentially unified us, right? I've overlapped into lots of other issues, but they do pertain to this central, pivotal concept of the oneness of mankind. And so I think we're all waiting for someone to champion that, some statesman. I believe our cherished outgoing president embodied it to a sense and came close to saying it. But we need those outspoken champions of the oneness of humanity who can distinguish between national autonomy and national sovereignty, so that even the UN doesn't get clogged, you know, in the Security Council by that veto that is just expressing national sovereignty. We are one planet, and so we're learning how to do it, but it is the birth pangs of a new world order, isn't it? Really painful and surprising, always getting blindsided by new developments. The most difficult of these three, probably, because religion is in such a debased condition, right, as it's in our face, is this concept of religion is one. So what Baha'is mean by that, on one hand, we're saying that the golden rule is the heart of really every religion when you study it. There is this moral dimension to reality, to the universe, to spiritual reality. And mankind, individuals, start to discover a sense of well-being if they get out of the prison of self and can, you know, first of all, see something from someone else's point of view, that empathy, and to practice the golden rule. So a lot of things flow from that. But so that's one sense in which we see religion as one. Another is that within religions, it's helpful to distinguish between the spiritual teachings and the social teachings. So these social teachings can be divisive if the religion is identified with it. Should you baptize babies or not? Should you do this or that? These things, if the religion is identified with that, then religion is nothing but divisive. And it along with politics, you can't talk about without ticking somebody off, right? Without getting angry yourself. It's just really hard. But when you look at religion in terms of its spiritual teachings, that there's this mysterious source that is manifested, not necessarily embodied or incarnated, but manifested in a figure that is like a pure mirror, like St. Paul said about Christ. So in addressing Christ, you're addressing God. Everything he said and did was God doing it, God being manifested in the world. So Baha'is see that, you know, there's this these sacred few, the ones that found religions. And so these are the ones that bring a book, capital B, and they bring a new calendar. So you can, you know, Google it and see who are these guys. They go back, some of them, names we'd hardly know about, like Zoroaster. He's made better known in the 19th century. Nietzsche refers to Zarathustra. Maybe Adam was the founder of Sabianism. We go way back, and it's really clouded. Even Krishna, was he an actual historic figure? Do we call him the founder of Hinduism? We get a little closer with Abraham and then Moses. There's a little more history. And we see them as folks who, not folks, but these sacred individuals who found a new dispensation, who are the educators of mankind. They are not tossed up by circumstances like, say, a Lincoln or a Gandhi, but they are the fathers and the founders of a new era through their absolute brilliance and through their lives and through their word. So this concept of the manifestation of God is key in Baha'i thinking, that we really regard religion as one, that it's one process, it's an unfolding process. So we can't think of a Jewish person, a Buddhist person, Hindu person, Catholic person as the other at all, because there's just one sun shining in the solar system. Similarly, there's the one God. So the mistake is made even by the best journalists. You'll say, talk about the different gods that people worship and so forth, but I think most people really understand when you think about it that just as the sun, you know, is called el sol and le soleil, and we say the sun, but it's the same reality, right? Just different languages, different points of the compass looking at it. And that the Godhead, this unknowable essence, we do apply terms and so forth, but that doesn't mean there are different gods. So when the poet Wallace Stevens says, so alarmingly, when you take him literally, says, the death of one God is the death of them all. So it seems like encapsulizing this death of God movement, but what he's getting at is, any God you can really get your mind around, really understands, like, ceases to be God, right? If we are a creature with all our imagination, all of our intuition, all of the subtlest aspects of inspiration that could lead a Shakespeare to do what he did and so forth, if that is a human being, then that's a creature and there is a creator. And so it just makes us realize each of us is a mirror in another sense. Each of us is a mirror in another sense, especially insofar as we acquire virtues and come out of that prison of self. And we start to feel the joy that is latent in reality, you know, that we feel in spring, but we can also feel it in winter and see the beauty of winter too. And so that this notion of the marvels around us, just the people around us, and of course we see it in children more directly because they've been less clouded by ego, right? So they're just there. So no one can believe in original sin when you see a baby, not literally, right? You can try to understand what's meant by that concept, probably has a deep theology to it. So I think the idea of predestination probably has a deep theology, so we don't want to sell John Calvin short, but just the idea that we are surrounded by miracles and we can appreciate it most easily in a way, getting out in nature, but then look at the person right next to us and without objectifying them, just having a sense of the presence of that person and then realizing, man, if it was an accident, you know, as some will say, that produced this, that's a heck of an accident. And God bless it. Let's capitalize the word accident. If accident can produce a person, that's amazing. So, of course, as believers, we believe there is this unknowable essence. Beyond space and time, we have to expand our theology the way astronomy has expanded, right? So it's the perfect model for us. The absolutely perfect model for us. We have to think in terms of the trillions and, you know, just unspeakable vastness, endless vastness. And then we go, okay, that's just creation, that's space and time. So that's what religions have always said, but now because science has developed so wonderfully, it's harder for religion to get its minds around reality in a sense. And so we're at this impasse where the Baha'i writings say that civilization is like a bird with two wings, religion and science. We need them both to have civilization. If you just have religion, like let's say in the Dark Ages, then things slow down in terms of progress in this world, and you're likely to have superstition and burning teenagers at the stake and all of this, that kind of stuff, or Al-Qaeda or ISIS. But if you just have religion and science, that's what I was saying, you just have science and religion is really weak, which is more our plight now, then you have a materialism. The cancer of materialism starts to creep. And we fail to distinguish between materialism and material progress. Material progress is fabulous, right? Who's going to knock that? But that's not what we mean by materialism. We're talking about that cancer that now we all know through the depression around us, right? So we're all afflicted by it to some extent. And then we learn how to pray, maybe, and to really stick with it. Like in Hawaii, where I'm from, some surfers, they'll paddle on their knees. Or they'll paddle sometimes lying down and then sometimes go to their knees. And so especially big wave surfers will have these big knobs on their knees. So maybe we need to be sort of worshipers and build some worship knobs on our knees. Especially if, you know, the depression goes on. We just keep at it and try to break through the clouds. But it's all in the effort. It's all in the effort, isn't it? And so it's just that we have to raise our kids understanding this, because it is really hard in our society with everything besieging our consciousness. All of it, a lot of it wonderful, but so much of it militating against our spiritual nature. forcing us to give little narrow concepts about the Christian or the believer and so forth. And then those people themselves have a narrow concept about themselves. We have to be as broad as science and broader, right? But as deep as our forebears, as deep as Jonathan Edwards, who, you know, started the Great Awakening, as deep as Edward Taylor, a wonderful poet up in Massachusetts, and Bradstreet, these wonderful figures who are spiritual forebears, the Puritans, as deep as they were, their narrowness led to all kinds of problems, but they had a depth we started to lose as science tilted in the 19th century, is my view anyway. But I know, just having lived quite a few years in this society, that we all are challenged with these things, and that when Baha'u'llah says that every one of these, of them, the manifestations of God, is the wake that connecteth this world with the realms above, and the standard of truth unto everyone in the kingdoms of earth and heaven. Then he says, he who is everlastingly hidden from the eyes of men. So if you stop there, then the depression gets even worse, right? He who is everlastingly hidden from the eyes of men can never be known except through his manifestation, and his manifestation can adduce no greater proof of his mission than the proof of his own person. So we have 19th century Iran, Shiite, intensely fanatical, you know, we're seeing it now. This movement begins, a young man named the Bab, you saw the gold-owned shrine of the Bab on the bosom of Carmel in that image. He says, a new day is dawning, 1844. Very same day that the telegraph was inventing by coincidence. And he said that he was the forerunner of this great one, prophesied by all of the religions. So in Judeo-Christianity, it would be like the world counselor, the father figure, who would come to be the shepherd for all of the flocks. The promised one of Christ would come. Christ is the return of the Father. And so Baha'u'llah, son of a minister in the Shah's court, offered by the Shah any position. He just couldn't go there. He was known as the father of the poor even in his 20s, began to give all of his fabulous wealth away. And then when this cause began by the Bab, he became a follower. The Bab knew that he was that promised one, and Baha'u'llah had some inkling too, probably, some amazing history. Anyway, 20,000 of the Bab's followers are slaughtered, martyred. Baha'u'llah is thrown into prison and then exiled. Successively ends up in the fortress prison in Akka in the 1870s. And so a prisoner for 40 years, but gives him a chance to write. And so in this era, all of the mental, intellectual things are sort of like, you know, they're on display among with these figures. And they lived so recently. We have all these anecdotes, all of the descriptions about them, particular Baha'u'llah's son, Abdu'l-Baha, who came to America, 1912. The Baha'i sent him a ticket to the Titanic. He sent it back and said, give the money to the poor, I can get a cheaper ride, or he would have been on the Titanic. But he comes, and he was very sad because he knew the people, they'd been on a different leg with him. And he comes over here in 1912, and the press just loves him. And he really makes quite a splash, but he's warning people, a war is coming unless you get it together. This is 1912. And then he talks about the warfare involving the spiritual and the material side of man, the materialism that's creeping and paralyzing our faculties. And again gives a stern warning as to that. These figures, like Abdu'l-Baha himself, not a manifestation of God, but everybody, there were headlines that said things like, prophet says he is no prophet. They kept saying, you must be like Isaiah. But he said, no, it's my father who has that station. And yet Abdu'l-Baha was so, he read people's thoughts, and he was so kind and always doing the right thing for a different person. And like the true Santa Claus, he would leave gifts on people's threshold and never want anybody to know who had given it. And that captures really his life. He talks about, he said, He was a prisoner for 60 years, but he said the worst prison is the prison of self. He said at the end of the day, we would all think of the funniest thing that happened that day. We'd be howling with laughter there in that awful prison. But he said, compared to Baha'u'llah, I am nothing. I'm like the moon that reflects the light of the sun. And so that supermoon, I thought of Abdu'l-Bahá a lot when that supermoon was coming, but then you compare them with the Christ figures. These are of another order, a great mystery, and they are the civilizers that come into the world. They may not be accepted for centuries. Christianity took 3 centuries, right, for it to come above ground. So this is the year 173 of the Baha'i era. And so a lot of people haven't heard of Baha'u'llah, but many of his teachings are current in the world now. The oneness of mankind, harmony of science and religion, equality of women and men, need to overcome all prejudices, the need for a world government, not uniformity, but, you know, unity and diversity. Got to get it organized, just as the planet is ecological. Get it organized. Or we're just going to ruin it. We got to get it together as a species. So I think I'm probably on over my time. I better stop there. Thank you very much for giving this opportunity.